From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, groups of activist Michigan Catholics challenging their bishops to weed out sexual predator priests.
Predatory priests are harming people, men, women, and children. They need to get out now, and if the bishops won't do it voluntarily, they're going to be made to do it.
Is Michigan failing parents who need mental health care for their kids? A class action suit argues, yes, it is.
In the wealthiest nation on earth, no family should go broke just because a child has a disability or illness. Not in Michigan or not anywhere in the country.
Oscar-nominated film Black Panther, an example of Afrofuturism.
So this is what we're doing. We're building the world that we have yet to experience that supports all aspects of Black life.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we continue looking into Michigan's mental health system for children and teens. Plus, we explore Afrofuturism. That comes up later this hour. But first, these are challenging times for the Roman Catholic Church, brought about by the scandal of sex abuse committed by priests and, in some cases, their superiors. Tomorrow, Pope Francis meets at the Vatican with the heads of the world's conferences of bishops. The meeting is called The Protection of Minors in the Church. It's described as a rallying moment to ensure that all bishops are on the same page in weeding out abusers and responding to abuse complaints. Last week, we learned powerful American Cardinal Theodore McCarrick is no longer powerful. He has been defrocked after the church found he had sexually abused minors and seminarians for decades. This was the first time a cardinal has been kicked out of the priesthood for offenses like this. Also tomorrow, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel will report on the state's investigation into sexual abuse committed by priests here in Michigan going back to 1950. That probe began under former AG Bill Schuette last summer, and it involves every diocese in Michigan, seven in all, covering some 2 million Michigan Catholics. Among those Catholics are my two guests today. Both are involved in grassroots groups of laypersons. They formed in response to the sex abuse problems in the church. Jason Negri is co-founder and executive director of the Daniel Coalition in the Lansing Diocese. Jason, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Richard Brenz is co-founder of the Gaylord Diocesan Watch. Dr. Brenz, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jason, I'll start with you. Why did you believe your activist group of lay Catholics is needed? What's the mission?
Well, the need is obvious. When the McCarrick affair broke last summer, there were lots of conversations taking place on social media, personally. Every Catholic really was concerned about this. We thought we had been through this with the previous scandals when they broke in Boston in 2002. Now here we are, more of the same. And while the statistics and the studies do indicate that the worst days in terms of abuse were behind us, the fact remains that much work still needs to be done, unfortunately. Many of the predators have been rooted out. However, some of them are still there. The focus was largely on sexual abuse of children, which is devastating and horrible to everybody. But not enough information has been out and not enough discussion has been had regarding sexual abuse of adults, which has been taking place, unfortunately, for as long as the church has been around. It's not a problem to the church, it's a problem to the human condition, but there's no place for it in the church. And the focus these days tends to be more on that, bringing those problems to the attention of the bishops and then encouraging them, shall we say, to do the right thing.
And Dr. Brenz, why co-found the Gaylord Diocesan Watch?
Like Jason said, part of the problem has been that we haven't had any protective mechanisms in place for adults. Oftentimes it's been viewed in the past that adult abuse was somehow consensual,
right,
that there was no interplay between the fact that one person was in a higher level, higher position of power over another. And while our primary goal here was to inform the public that a priest of ours had been what we felt to be unfairly disciplined for reporting abuse, we felt that there's also a need here in our community to have an alternative for people to report abuse to, because right now your options are you can report to the civil police or you can report to the diocese. Well, for a vast number of reasons, those aren't very favorable places to respond for most people. They want some place that feels safer. And so Gaylord Diocesan Watch kind of arose to try to fill that need.
Let's talk about two cases of accusations leveled against priests in your respective dioceses. Both accusers are junior priests.
priests, not minors, not children. And Dr. Brenz, you were referring to the sexual harassment allegations against Father Dennis Stillwell, a Petoskey pastor. Tell us briefly about this and the response from the Diocese of Gaylord.
Father Matthew Cowan is a priest who's only been a priest for 5 years, and in his first assignment as a priest, he was assigned in the Petoskey parish of St. Francis Xavier under Father Stillwell. And Father Cowan made allegations 2 years after the fact now that Father Stillwell had inappropriately touched him in a sexual manner. He reported this to the diocese, who then reported it to civil authorities, and civil authorities said that the statute of limitations had expired on making that sort of claim. And Father Cowan has been what we would call railroaded and steamrolled in that he's not heard anything specifically from the diocese, or at least he hadn't for about 5 months, and felt that with the advent of the McCarrick case becoming public, he too had been sexually groomed.
And the response of the Diocese of Gaylord was, as I understand it, not to remove Father Stillwell, but to remove his accuser.
Correct. Father Cowan was placed on an administrative leave for 6 months' time for reasons that only the bishop knows. The accused, Father Stillwell, was left in his full administrative capacity as Vicar General of the diocese.
And in the case of your diocese, Jason Negri, tell us about the accusations against Father Mark Englott, who was pastor of East Lansing St. Thomas Aquinas Parish.
Substantially similar situation. You have a younger junior associate pastor who made allegations against Father Mark Englott for sexual harassment. Now, in the sexual realm, in workplace environments, this sort of stuff just does not happen. In the Me Too generation, we're very well aware of the differential in power. The power dynamic really does tend to put people off, so it's understandable why subordinates would be reluctant to bring these sorts of things forward. Well, in this case, they were brought forward. The response on the part of the diocese was to remove both priests from the parish, with, from what I understand, a minimal explanation as to why. And the result, of course, was a lot of talk among the parishioners wondering why exactly this happened, who's telling the truth. People were lining up in camps supporting either of the priests because nobody was completely certain exactly what happened. And I understand the bishop was under a little bit of pressure because, of course, the associate pastor was embarrassed to have had to say something about this, that the unwanted attention in these types of situations is very uncomfortable. So I get that. But they were both removed. The parish was thrown into turmoil. And a canonical investigation was launched into Father Englott, and the results of which apparently resulted in his removal, and that the diocese just came out with that statement a couple of days ago. The problem here is, of course, the statement that the diocese made was insufficient.
Not transparent.
No, not at all. The headline simply said that he was, quote, granted senior status. To the average person, even to the average Catholic, they don't know what that means. Normally, when a priest is granted senior status, it's simply a transition of what we would call retirement. They don't have a permanent full-time assignment. They have their priestly faculties. They are called upon very often, especially in these days of priest shortages, to fill in and to do what's necessary. Well, lower down in the announcement, the diocese did say, of course, that his priestly faculties have been removed. But again, the average person doesn't know what that means. They may think that's an ordinary part of transition to senior status. It needs to be made clear why he was removed, that this was in fact a punishment.
Why is oversight by lay groups like yours, people who are not priests, why are they needed? When you look at cases like this, Dr. Brenz, why does a group like yours matter?
Catholics have historically been people that have been referred to as those who pay, pray, and obey, meaning we have much reverence for our priests and bishops. We don't call into question any of their actions until such time as it starts to affect children. Now, this is wrong at its core. You know, we should be interested when it affects anybody. But because the priests themselves are beholden to the bishop, and the bishop really controls their lives, they're less likely to come forward and to make allegations, especially when you see that another priest has been taken to the woodshed, so to speak, over his allegations. It just promotes secrecy, and it increases the opacity rather than increasing transparency in the church.
And the whole issue of transparency and opacity is something that is at the root of all of the headlines we hear about the church's historic handling of accusations against priests. Well, now we have the state of Michigan. Tomorrow, we get an update from Attorney General Dana Nessel. Is this outside probe something, Jason, that you welcome as a lay Catholic?
I absolutely do. The rationale for this is the same rationale for why we have to have lay Catholic groups providing this accountability. Predatory priests are harming people, men, women, and children. They need to get out now, and if the bishops won't do it voluntarily, they're going to be made to do it, whether by the civil law, in this case the investigations by the Attorney General, or the shame of public exposure, or the revolt of the faithful, which is exactly what you have happening right now. Our groups didn't exist a year ago. They exist now. We're not leaving the church. We don't want to destroy the church, but this level of accountability is a necessary component. We're taking co-responsibility for our church.
Dr. Brenz?
Jason's absolutely right. In our role as a diocesan watch group, we've appealed to the bishop to let us help him be a better bishop, to let us help him find out what's going on in the diocese, to try to make the concerns of the normal parishioner his concerns. And he said that he may not be a very good father, and we're here to help him in that fatherly role as much as we can.
How does all of this, Jason, affect everyone in Michigan, whether they're Catholic or not Catholic?
Well, I think whether you're Catholic or not, there is a tendency among everybody to look to the Catholic Church as having some special standing. I mean, the old joke is everybody hates Catholics until you need an exorcist. There's very much a position of tradition and heritage and authority that the Catholic Church has, whether you subscribe to her beliefs or not. So for the Church, which is supposed to be a steward of the teachings of the holiest man to ever walk the earth, if they're failing in this responsibility and institutionally covering up predators, that demoralizes everybody. The church needs to get its own house in order. I mean, Pope Francis has characterized the church as a field hospital where the wounds and hurts of the world can be bound up and healed. And that's true, but it's the worst sort of cognitive dissonance for representatives of that same institution to be the cause of so many hurts and ills. It needs to change.
Dr. Brenz, what are you looking for from Attorney General Nessel tomorrow?
Well, I think we're looking for her to, number one, be bluntly honest about how widespread the scandal is and to give us information that we can use in our own diocese to address the scandal and to help formulate new programs within the diocese that might help prevent this in the future, especially as it refers to the abuse of adults. We already have policies that treat children, but we need more to protect everybody and not just them.
Exactly.
Jason Negri and Dr. Richard Brenz, both founders of activist lay watch groups in their respective dioceses, Lansing Diocese and the Gaylord Diocese. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the film Black Panther brought Afrofuturism into the mainstream, but the movement has been going strong in Detroit for decades. We'll hear how it's influencing artists and activists after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
I, Zuri, son of Badu, give to you Prince T'Challa, the Black Panther.
The release of the film Black Panther a year ago was a major cultural moment featuring a black superhero protagonist, a black director, a majority black cast. That film raked in over $1.3 billion worldwide. It broke all kinds of box office records, including the highest grossing film by a black director. And this Sunday night, Black Panther is up for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Original Music Score, Best Production Design, and more. The audiences who flocked to see the story of Black Panther in their movie theaters and the nation of Wakanda were, whether they knew it or not, seeing a story inspired by Afrofuturism. It's a school of thought that's been influencing people in storytelling, music, politics, art, and much more, including my next guest. Bree Gant is a photographer and filmmaker in Detroit. Among her work, Afrofuture Past, a 2-part dance film set in Detroit. And Adrienne Ayers, known as Numi. She's founder of Afrofuture Youth, a year-round after-school program giving black high schoolers another outlet to learn, create, and explore. And it is a pleasure to welcome you both to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks
I'm excited to be
us.
Here.
Great. Well, back at you. Numi, I want to start with having you tell us more about Afrofuture Youth. Just what's the mission and how do you go about it?
The mission and purpose of Afrofuture Youth is for Black Detroit high schoolers to imagine the world that they have yet to see that supports all of their identities associated with their Black lives. Being Black, being queer, and any other intersecting identities on top of our Blackness. Being able to imagine a world that supports these these identities and supports the identities of other Black community members that we also share space with. So we're just using imagination through the framework of Afrofuturism to start to actually physically build this world. So this is what we're doing. We're building the world that we have yet to experience that supports all aspects of Black life.
Well, there we go. And I know, Bri, you grew up in Detroit. You went away for a while, and then you came back to Detroit. What stories do you want to tell through your photographs, through your art, through your film?
I think that was one of the biggest things I learned leaving Detroit and coming back is the vastness of Blackness. You know, we're being from, I love growing up and being from Detroit, Detroit Public Schools. Mm-hmm. Went to Cass, went to Golightly, and then left and went to Howard, where I learned that Blackness was so much bigger than 6 Mile. As much as I love 6 Mile, you know, and that 6 Mile exists in Cuba, it exists in Ghana, it exists in Nigeria, it exists in Brazil, and that I exist so much outside of Detroit. And that's a lot of what Afrofuture Past is and what Afrofuturism is, that Blackness exists outside of what we've seen so far.
All right. Let's kind of take that and talk a little more about what you believe Afrofuturism is and what it isn't.
Afrofuturism, how we usually see it, mm-hmm. is imagining Black life in science fiction concepts that we don't normally get to see. And that's how it's usually presented to people, like through Black Panther and other films associated with that. But how I'm starting to imagine Afrofuturism for myself is imagining the reality that we have yet to see right now that can impact the identities and impact how we thrive in life today. And so simply imagining these things is also futuristic. It's also science fiction because we have yet to see a society in a realm where Black life has access to clean water and equitable education or healthy food sources, or their existence isn't at risk, you know, just for being. That's something that we've only imagined. Black life and equity has not been something we've experienced. And so when you start to imagine what does that world actually look like and the reality that we need, then that's actually also Afrofuturism, because it's something that you have yet to see, yet to experience. So just bringing that back to the now for me.
So it sounds like it's a lens that you're using in the work you're doing.
Mm-hmm. A lens of critique, a way to understand and experience contemporary Blackness mm-hmm. outside of the lens of a Western philosophy. It's a way that we can ground ourselves in what's happening today through African cosmologies and aesthetics.
Now, the idea of what Afrofuturism is, it seems it's growing. It should not be pigeonholed. I started off by talking about Black Panther because the thing that what do you guys both want to say about that film? I'm looking at Bri. Bri's like, let me talk about Black Panther.
Please.
All right. What do you want to say
so
about
so many feelings, a lot of complex and intersecting feelings. I was very excited for it. I bought my ticket a month in advance for the screening the day before, Wakanda Forever.
Yes.
And afterwards, I took my parents to see it after that screening. And my mother texted me and she was like, you know, thank you for that. I feel so much bigger and better in my brown skin, because we're cinephiles. Like, we love watching movies in my family. We love watching sci-fi movies, adventure and action movies. We love it. And that is the first movie that really reflected who we are on screen. So it was a very, mm-hmm. very big change. And at the same time, I think that this speaks to the question that you initially asked, what is Afrofuturism and what isn't it? I don't want to say what it isn't, because I think that a lot of Blackness has been trapped in what it isn't. And we don't need those conversations anymore. Mm-hmm. But please believe that Black Panther is the tippy tip top of the Afrofuture iceberg.
And I know, Noomi, you want to talk about it too. So the excitement. Yeah. What did you feel that film represented?
I feel like that represented something, once again, what we have yet to see. It's about building mm-hmm. this future. It's about building what we've been waiting on as, like, collectively as Black people, and to see representation on that level where it's not just a couple characters here and there that are, like, supporting and are Black, yeah. but the entire cast, minus, like, one person, but we're not even focused on that. The entire cast,
the CIA.
Right? Right. Like, the entire cast is Black, and women are taking this lead role. as not just people who are like behind the scenes and nurturers in this community, but are also like the warriors. Like, so many don't know the warrior stories behind a lot of the women in our communities. And it's like we're fighting and we're protecting in so many ways. And I think that gets overshadowed and overlooked. And it was very beautiful to see, especially with a lot of the ideas that we heard throughout the film, especially coming from Nakia, who wasn't just focused on like what's happening specifically here right now in Wakanda, but like what about the collective of other people who look like us? Like, how are we intersecting and like taking these what's happening here?
So are there practical applications or solutions based on Afrofuturism that you use in everyday life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For me, it's a visioning process. Just like Numi said, it's a way of understanding this reality that I'd even challenge that and say most people haven't experienced. I've been thinking a lot about writings of Martin Luther King Jr., both popular and less popular writings that Martin Luther King Jr. has done, but specifically the phrase that I've been to the mountaintop. And I very much relate to that. Like, I know that the reality that Numi talks about is real. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I see it when I get to hang out with Numi every time. I see it when we get to be in our spaces of mm-hmm. underground art shows in Detroit. That's real. And it's this Afrofuturism is this practical application of it. It's been happening. It has always been happening for decades, since before the term was coined in 1994.
Exactly.
And before people got excited about shows and movies like Black Panther, like. And that's another reason why it's the tippy tip top of the iceberg.
Exactly. I think it also just gives people a new way to look at this work, because the work, like Bree said, was already being done. We've already been living this thing. So like there are a set of like principles for Afrofuturism. This doesn't mean like everybody has to adhere to these principles. You know, like if they apply to you as you do this work, cool. But like one of them is co-creation. And so like we've been doing this work in these underground music scenes and art scenes and everything together. But just the simple fact that these spaces are majority Black spaces that are creating together, that is building and continuously building the future that we need to see. That's one way that we apply these things to real life and tenets of Afrofuturism. There's also the ancestor connection, which was uplifted in the movie Black Panther. Mm-hmm. Connecting with our ancestors in so many different levels in so many different ways is a very big thing amongst the Black community. And especially from spiritual like perspectives, it helps us like make decisions and helps us with guidance, especially understanding that energy doesn't die, it just continues on. And so how you tap into that energy, not just out of respect, because a lot of people think, okay, we need to honor our ancestors just out of respect, or it's a nice thing to do. And like, yeah, no, that's cute. But also, also, like there's actual literal guidance here if you know how to do the work to tap into it and to keep that energy flowing, and you can recognize the signs and the ways that your ancestors actually do speak to you. It's a very, very real practice, and it's really important.
In the last couple of minutes we have, we could talk for hours with both of you. Yes. You're so fun. What do you feel that this school of thought, this Afrofuturism and the lens that it offers, what could it mean to us here in Michigan, Bree?
It speaks a lot to what's happening in Detroit right now with gentrification. We like to pigeonhole that conversation in Black and white and good and bad. And it's more of a conversation around existence and care and narrative that have existed and will continue to exist. And that's one of the biggest things that Afrofuturism resists, is this idea that Black people exist in the past. Black people exist in one instance, in one point in American history. Mm-hmm. And it's also resisting this future that whiteness proposes, that will be a historyless future. There won't be identities, individual identities in this future. But it's not necessary to progress or to have this, what some people call a utopia, but it's just, it's what can be our reality if we decide it, that can include all of who we are. It's about centering the diaspora and allowing the diaspora to have the power that it already mm-hmm. does, and to travel as it pleases without trying to pigeonhole it into this one instance in time.
Final words from Numi. What can it mean for Michigan?
Well, what it can mean for Michigan is centering Black voices and understanding the complexity in Black stories, and that there's not just one binary like way to look at how Blackness shows up. There are so many things and ways that we show up, but also understanding that there are some things that because people are not like sharing these identities with us, there are some things that they might not understand. And it's okay if other people are not a part of that understanding, as long as our autonomy and our agency that we are actively reclaiming to build this future is respected. Not everything is for everybody. This is about us and it's for us. And that needs to be respected. So we're building our own future, because right now that being left in the hands of other people does not allow room for us to thrive and to have the space that we need to be okay. So that means building the future we need and thinking about what does thriving and having the lives that we need where all our identities are respected looks like. So it looks like so many things.
Activist Numi, who's the founder of Afrofuture Youth, and artist, photographer, filmmaker Brigant. Thank you to both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Cindy. So much. Appreciate it.
Let's continue exploring Afrofuturism. We turn to the Norwest Gallery of Art in Detroit, celebrating Black History Month with an exhibition called Supreme, A Voyage to Afrofuturism. Asia Hamilton is director and chief curator. Asia, what is the big message of this exhibit?
Pretty much we are focusing on futuristic and scientific ideas, ancient African traditions. It's like reimagining our culture had it been untouched by Western society. So the imagery and the art and everything that's a part of Supreme is pretty much just kind of like a projection into the future for African culture.
I've seen it described the developing collision of science fiction technology with the African diaspora. What does that mean to you?
I mean, pretty much it is a mixture of technology and, you know, futuristic ideas mixed with our Black culture.
And I know this is a multidisciplinary art exhibit. Give us an idea of the kinds of things in the exhibit and who the artists are.
Well, you know, we have a range of different mediums. It's a totally multimedia exhibition. We have an artist, Mr. Matthew Corbin. He's got a series of like found objects and things that he's collected, you know, just from walking along the street or driving on the freeway or wherever. And he's put these pieces together to create these like almost African masks, but they look futuristic in their elements. Like, you know, some of them have, you know, light bulbs or different things that's inside of them that give them that futuristic feel.
And he's a Detroiter, right?
Yes, he is. He's also my high school teacher. So we have artists that are well up in age in this exhibit, all the way down into their very early 20s. So I love to have a nice range of artists, too, because it gives a different perspective on the title of what the piece is.
And you've got artists from really all around the world.
Absolutely. Von Mash, who is he solely does Afrofuturistic work. He works in a digital medium, so he does like a mix between painting and, you know, photography and just, you know, collaging and creating these Afrofuturistic pieces. He is actually in South Africa. And then we have another artist, Young Yimmy. He's in Toronto. So we got artists Toronto, Chicago, South Africa, all the way to Detroit.
And I know that you have events that you've built around the exhibit and about Afrofuturism. What kinds of things are you planning?
Well, we got a cosmic conversation. This will be curated by Ingrid LaFleur, who is an Afrofuturist herself, and Tanya Stevens. They are doing conversations with real-life Afrofuturists that are here in Detroit. So it's pretty much just a view into the movement and how it's demonstrated in everyday lives. So that would be February the 27th and March the 6th on Wednesdays. We also have the story behind the art, which is one of my favorites. We do that for every exhibition. It's a artist talk. You know, so the artist will be explaining their inspiration behind their pieces and just talking about the stories and where they came up with these, you know, these amazing concepts.
What do you hope people will take away from exploring Afrofuturism through this exhibition, Supreme?
I'm hoping that people will just be, you know, just kind of celebrate the uniqueness and innovation of Black culture. You know, just not only will it bring a sense of pride and, you know, just kind of like an unapologetic celebration for Black people, but just an overall understanding of, you know, our culture in a diverse way across the spectrum.
The exhibition is Supreme, A Voyage to Afrofuturism, and you can get all kinds of details on the exhibition and all the events related with it by going to the Norwest Gallery of Art website, norwestgallery.com, and it is worth noting that the Norwest Gallery is an arts grant recipient from the Knight Foundation. Asia Hamilton, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
In the midst of this wintry weather, may I invite you to daydream. Dream about a lovely summer stroll in Paris or the French Riviera, or staying in a 15th century chateau, or walking the historic beaches of Normandy on this 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and so much more. That daydream can happen because I am leading Michigan Radio listeners on a tour of France this summer. Now, most of the spaces on the tour are taken, but we have a handful of spots left for you to come along on this beautiful French adventure with us. Just visit michiganradio.org/travel and you'll find all the details. Coming up, we'll catch up with the Michigan History Center and learn about the architect of the Ambassador Bridge. And then we continue our series looking at Michigan's mental health system for children. That comes in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Just as bridge workers are busy building the new Gordie Howe Bridge between Windsor and Detroit these days, 90 years ago, workers were doing the same, building the Ambassador Bridge connecting Michigan with Ontario. But one of the architects of that bridge is only now beginning to get some recognition. He is Cornelius L. Henderson. And to explain, we welcome back Rachel Clark with the Michigan History Center. Hello, Rachel.
Hello.
And we want to welcome Rashid Faisal. He's the director of faculty and instruction at Old Redford Academy District. Rashid recently wrote an article on Henderson for Michigan History Magazine, published by the Michigan Historical Society. Rashid, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Rachel, give us some context here. We're talking, you know, the roaring 20s in Detroit, cities booming, and what, it's getting obvious the ferry services were not able to keep up with all the people who wanted to go back and forth between Windsor and Detroit. So in hindsight, building the Ambassador Bridge was a necessity, but was the project welcomed at that time?
For the most part, yes, but not entirely. So just about everyone, from the president and Congress to Canadian Prime Minister and Parliament, they were in favor of a bridge. It had been talked about for about 40 years at that point. However, Detroit Mayor John Smith, he was against it, and he also had veto power. So he argued that after the bridge was built, taxpayers and bridge users would be left to pay for its upkeep, while the owners of the bridge would just always profit from it. So there was one very loud voice that did not approve of the bridge.
A powerful voice. Isn't that interesting that we can stop and say, you know, the Gordie Howe Bridge has certainly had been a political hot potato and back and forth. And you kind of see echoes of that when you talk about opposition to the Ambassador Bridge.
Absolutely. There's a lot of comparisons there.
And ultimately, what happened?
So Smith, when all is said and done, Smith actually does use his veto power for the bridge. And the city council overrides that veto, and it winds up in Wayne County Circuit. And there's a restraining order against construction until there could be a popular referendum. The mayor assumes that the people of Detroit will vote against the bridge, but he's wrong. And it actually gets voted in. But during all this time, the construction bids are actually going out, and one of the bids that comes back is for the Canadian Bridge Company. They won one of the smaller bids.
And ultimately, the Canadian Bridge Company, the CBC, got that contract, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. They did.
Thus enters Cornelius L. Henderson. Rashid, give us some background. Where did he grow up and where did he go to school?
The Henderson family was part of that first group of African Americans that were migrating to Michigan between roughly 1880 and 1910. So he was born in Detroit on December 11th, 1887. But his father, Reverend James Henderson, was an academic who took a position as a president of a historically black college at Morris Brown University in Atlanta. So Henderson, at roughly around the age of six, spent a majority of his time up to graduating from high school down in Atlanta, Georgia, where he had demonstrated really an early proficiency in mathematics. And after graduating from Payne University in 1906, he ended up at the University of Michigan as an engineering student, at the time the only African-American enrolled in the engineering program.
And did he have any difficulty getting admitted to U of M? What did that take?
Well, at the time, Michigan was really one of the more, you would say, liberal universities. A student came in with a basic qualification, which he did, having studied at Payne University, where he really showed exceptional ability in mathematics. He was able to gain admission.
And he gets this University of Michigan engineering degree. And then did he have an easy time finding employment?
Well, here's the thing. During the time that he was at the University of Michigan, his professor stated he had a proficiency in engineering and architectural design that was very, very advanced, because during that particular time, you had what you would call kind of normative segregation. In the South, you had legal segregation, but here in the North, you had it by norm, by practice, by custom. So Henderson spent all 5 years in the engineering department basically working alone without any interactions with his other classmates. So his professor stated that he had a proficiency level that was really, really advanced because he did all of his work without help. So upon graduation, Henderson, with an engineering degree, was looking for employment in Detroit. And one engineering firm in particular stated that the only position open to someone like him because of his race was that of a janitor. So I found that very, very, very interesting. But he ended up running across one of his classmates, one of the few white classmates that would speak with him. And this classmate by the name of E.K. Bash recommended that he apply for a position at the Canadian Bridge Company, which Henderson did. And he was employed initially as a draftsman.
So he got in, and there he was then when this contract is awarded to the Ambassador Bridge to build the Ambassador Bridge.
Yes, yes. He had already worked his way up from a draftsman to the stock department. And the year prior to the Canadian Bridge Company winning the contract, he had moved up to design engineer. He had already worked on some projects in Canada in terms of designing bridges, so he was pretty much experienced at that point. So it was really, I guess you would call it, the perfect storm coming together, the contract and then Henderson's movement up the ranks to becoming an actual design engineer.
Rachel Clark, what were some of the technical issues that Henderson and the other engineers at the Canadian Bridge Company faced in planning a suspension bridge like the Ambassador Bridge? We're talking about, you know, technology that's nearly a century old.
The biggest thing that they had to sort of deal with was the sheer size that this bridge was going to have to be. It was going to have to be a suspension bridge. They couldn't sink pillars into the river because then ships couldn't get past it. So it had to be a suspension bridge. The only suspension bridge in the world at that time that was anywhere near it was the Brooklyn Bridge. That was the longest bridge at that time. And the Ambassador Bridge was going to have to be about 1,500 feet longer in total length. And then the span was going to have to be about 250 feet longer. So just the sheer size of this bridge was the biggest technical feat that they had to get over. And so Henderson, with, as it was just stated, his new job was structural engineer, and he had to design these steel structures to hold this bridge together, not only to hold it up, but to hold the weight that was going to be going across it.
So this was really groundbreaking, engineering progress they made, because I know the Golden Gate Bridge didn't come along until 1933.
Yep. This was the one that sort of leads the way into a lot of other bridges that pop up other bridges that are built in the 30s. So this is it. And Henderson's work leads the way for that.
Rashid, what else did Cornelius Henderson work on after finishing the Ambassador Bridge? And also, why was he buried in the footnotes of history for so long?
Well, starting with his work on the Edmonton High Level Bridge in 1913, I think that's where he really showed off his abilities. After the Ambassador Bridge, he was involved with the Ford Motor Company plant in 1929, the General Electric factory building the same year, the Welland Vertical Lift Bridge in Welland, Canada, the Thousand Island Bridge in Ontario, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Headquarters in Ottawa. And he was also responsible for Detroit Memorial Park Cemetery, which was the first African-American-owned cemetery in the state of Michigan.
And also involved in constructing the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel?
Yes, definitely. We don't want to forget that because we're still talking about, as my colleague stated, using his knowledge of steel design to basically create the first underwater tunnel linking Detroit to Windsor, Canada.
A 47-year career with the Canadian Bridge Company is something very much to be noted. So it's great to know that he's getting recognized for being so important. And every time we drive over the Ambassador Bridge or we go through that tunnel, we should give a hat tip to Cornelius Henderson.
Definitely, definitely. When you speak of hidden figures, Henderson was definitely one of those. Mm-hmm. And just today, or contemporary, American society is now ready to recognize the contributions of these African-American hidden figures that participated in moving us along in the STEM occupations.
Rashid Faisal is Director of Faculty and Instruction for the Old Redford Academy, and also Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark, as we talk about African-American engineer and architect Cornelius L. Henderson, whose work on the Ambassador Bridge and Detroit-Windsor Tunnel lives on into the 21st century. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me as well.
Where do you go? To whom do you turn if your child needs mental health care? Providers, advocates, and parents agree. Options in Michigan are too few and far between, and this reality has spurred a class action lawsuit. The suit was filed in 2018 against then-Governor Snyder and the State Department of Health and Human Services. It alleges the state has failed to meet its legal obligation under Medicaid to provide adequate services for children with behavioral and mental health problems. Earlier this month, a federal judge ruled this lawsuit may proceed towards trial. Here now is former state senator and state representative David Honigman. He's partner at the law firm Mantis Honigman, and he is the lead attorney in this class action suit. So, David, outline for us the central claim against the state in this case, KB v. DHHS.
Well, the state is not providing what's shorthand is called the EPSDT benefit under the Medicaid program. That stands for Early Periodic Screening, Diagnosis, and Treatment. And basically, it's all the medical and mental health care that a child from a family of modest means is entitled to. They're entitled to the same medical care that someone with private health insurance would get under federal law.
Okay, so exactly how is that happening? How is the state failing to provide, as you say, screening, diagnosis, and treatment? That's pretty across the board. How is the state failing to do this for these minors who receive Medicaid benefits?
Well, they're failing in multiple respects, and they're not just failing by a little bit. They're unfortunately failing radically. Here, let me give you an example. There's a young man who's a plaintiff in our lawsuit. P.S., let's use him. He's a nonverbal 20-year-old boy who has intermittent explosive disorder. That means he has, you know, very severe behavioral outbursts and aggressive temper tantrums. He has autism. He has intellectual disabilities. He has cerebral palsy. So because of his illnesses and disorders, he displays intermittent and severe aggression, outbursts of rage, inattention, agitation, food stealing. Even though his parents, or his mother, actually, had been requesting mental health services and medical attention for him for years, he was finally only referred to the community mental health program's autism program when he turned 17, and at that time, only minimal services were offered. ABA is called Applied Behavior Analysis. That's the only effective treatment for autism, and you're supposed to start out getting it 35, 40 hours a week. And over time, you can reduce the treatment, and the earlier the intervention, the better.
And he was 17 before he ever got referred.
before he got any. And even then, the service that they were offering him was way below the amount of service that he needed.
So what we're seeing is people are not getting services when they need it, and they're certainly not getting the degree of services they need. And I know a federal judge recently allowed most of the claims in your suit to proceed to discovery and go on to trial. It was Judge Thomas Ludington, and he found that your side had satisfied him, claiming laws in the Constitution had been violated. So tell us what laws and what part of the Constitution you believe has been violated.
Well, number one, the Medicaid statute. In a federal statute known as 1983, the Civil Rights Act, which requires that people with disabilities and mental illnesses or physical illnesses too, but our clients are mostly kids with mental illnesses and related physical illnesses, they're entitled under federal law, under the Medicaid statute, to have the medical treatment they need, whatever is medically necessary, paid for by the state. The state gets a lot of money from the federal government. It varies from state to state, but the federal government pays anywhere from half to three quarters of the cost of these services, and the state pays for a half to a quarter of the cost. And in return for the federal government paying this large share of the cost of medical and mental health services for poor children, the state is required to follow the federal law that it provide all medically necessary treatment, and it's not doing that.
And we know that the state contracts with the prepaid inpatient health plans, the PIHPs, and the local county medical health service programs to provide that. And the state's arguing, hey, we've executed these contracts, so we've fulfilled our duty.
Yes, and the court held that merely making a contract isn't enough. The state is required to ensure that their contractors actually provide adequate service. They can't just contract for the service, wash their hands of the whole matter, and not monitor and guarantee that their contractors actually deliver the services they're supposed to deliver.
And you've got seven plaintiffs listed in this complaint?
Yes.
And ultimately, how large do you believe the potential class is for this suit?
Well, we won't know that for sure until after discovery, but it's certainly tens of thousands of children and potentially hundreds of thousands. And, of course, the relief we hope to obtain will continue indefinitely into the future. So over time, you're talking about millions of Michigan children.
And what do you hear and what do you feel is the biggest barrier to the state in providing the appropriate mental and behavioral health care to these kids?
You know, it's money. It costs a lot of money to care for these kids in the short term. Remember, this is early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. So the earlier the intervention, the more effective it is. So in the long run, it's actually less costly and more efficient to do intensive, comprehensive intervention at the youngest age possible. But the state, and this is not just true of Michigan, but most U.S. states, they tend to have a short-term focus. And there's also a lack of political responsiveness to the needs of the vulnerable. They may vote less frequently than parents from wealthier households.
So it feels like they're easier to forget?
They're easier to forget, but in the wealthiest nation on earth, no family should go broke just because a child has a disability or illness. Not in Michigan or not anywhere in the country.
And when do you expect this suit to get to trial? You've got to go through discovery. What are you hoping as far as a timetable for trial?
Well, I'm hoping the state will actually, now that the court has ruled that our claims are legally valid, of course we have to prove that the services aren't being offered, but that evidence is overwhelming. There's no way for the state to really deny that adequate services are being provided. The state itself has done their own reports and studies, and their working groups have found that services are radically deficient. So I'm hoping, and I anticipate this is going to happen, that we'll just be able to bargain with them and they'll agree to provide better services. Nobody's really against these kids. It's just it's easy to ignore them in favor of groups with lobbyists and that make campaign contributions and groups that vote in greater numbers. That's why we have to bring a lawsuit.
David Honigman, lead attorney in a class action suit that accuses the state of Michigan of failing to provide adequate services for children who have behavioral and mental health problems. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thanks so much, Cynthia. Good speaking with you.
We reached out to the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, and they provided us this statement. I am quoting, "We cannot comment on ongoing litigation. However, MDHHS is committed to working with partners to address mental health needs in Michigan. Our request to discuss Michigan's mental health system for children more broadly and what the department is doing to improve it was declined." Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.